Well, we certainly saw a lot of interesting quote-unquote suicides during, say, the Ed Wilson case. A lot of suicides and near suicides and things of that nature. Okay, skipping along, a segment that comes up in the Control of Candy Jones has to do with John Neville's discovery under hypnosis of some rather odd training besides the regular sort of CIA courier training that Candy Jones underwent under the hypnoprogramming by Dr. Gilbert Jensen, again, a pseudonym. John Neville found that that Candy responded very strangely to certain people, ways that he thought were anomalous, especially to friends of his, for no particular reason that he could figure out. Well, as he continued this hypno-deprogramming, he began to find more and more that there had been apparently specific hate training is the term that Donald Bain uses in The Control of Candy Jones, by the mind control experts on Candy Jones herself, actually training her to hate whole groups of people. Now, after we finish reading some of these segments, we'll speculate a little bit on what that might mean. Anyway, again, from The Control of Candy Jones. In an hypnotic session recorded on April 10th, 1974, Arlene, again, that's Candy's dual personality, Arlene emerged in an angry, bitchy mood. After berating Candy for 2 minutes, and after claiming that Candy's mother was, quote, crazy as a hoot owl, and bragging that she had accompanied Candy to visit her mother in the hospital and had made some comments that drove Candy's mother out of her mind, Arlene got into the business of what she and Candy had been taught by Gilbert Jensen. She referred to Candy's mother's doctor as a, quote, kike. She was laughing cruelly throughout this session and began to repeat with apparent glee, kike, kike, kike. She told Neville that the doctor was the kind of kike that he, meaning Neville, would have on his radio show. She said that the kinds of kikes Neville was friendly with were the obnoxious and aggressive types. She then said scornfully, quote, Candy doesn't even have enough sense to know when they're pigs. She continued her tirade against the Jews and, approximately 15 minutes into the recorded session, bragged that Gilbert Jensen had told her, Arlene, that she should not like Jews. Later in this session, at approximately 19 minutes, Arlene denied having said that Jensen instructed her to hate Jews. But she quickly added, quote, Jews are bad. In a session recorded in January 1974, Candy mentioned that Arlene got along very nicely with Gilbert Jensen. She indicated that one of the reasons Jensen liked Arlene was that Arlene thought the way he did and was willing to take his advice. John Neville asked Candy what ethnic groups Jensen considered dangerous. Candy, quote, the Jewish people, of course, he called them kikes, and the American niggers, as he called them. He always used the name niggers. You know, he was Jewish himself, but he didn't like me to tell him that. He said there was a difference between Jews. John, before you met Jensen, how did you feel about people of the Jewish faith? Candy, I didn't feel anything. Then in parentheses it says, according to Candy, she had had many close Jewish friends and business associates prior to becoming involved with Jensen and the CIA.
Still a little later, Donald Bain continues with Neville's account of the hate training that Candy Jones received. Neville, still playing Jensen, asked, do you hate me? I only hate things that are worth hating, Arlene replied. You taught me that. I'm not worth hating, is that it? You should know, you taught me everything. Okay, Arlene. Arlene repeated a motto that Jensen had obviously used on many occasions. Only hate that which is worth hating. Well, that's good advice, isn't it? Neville asked. Yeah, especially since almost everything is worth hating, according to you. I never said you should hate everything, did I? You hate yourself, Arlene told Jensen. You hate just about everybody and everything. I never told you to hate everything, Neville said in his role as Gilbert Jensen. It all boils down to that, said Arlene. You told me that there was hate in everybody, and sooner or later it would come out.
Okay. Skipping along, he then asked her whether she had attended one of Berger's classes in California. Now, Berger is another prep programmer that was being used at the time by the CIA, and we're going to find out about those classes in a moment. He then asked her whether she had attended one of Berger's classes in California. She said she had. Neville asked her whether it was an ethnic hate class. Quote, it's his regular lecture, Candy said. He also lectures on hypnosis, Neville asked. Candy agreed. Neville then asked her what Berger generally said in his ethnic group classes. Quote, I don't know. He said you have to be careful about what you say to certain types of people. The ethnic attitudes instilled in Candy by Jensen and Berger were as distasteful as those represented by the crudest of today's ethnic, quote, humor. Because of Candy's high ratings on scent tests, there appears to have been an emphasis placed upon what Berger claimed were peculiar odors emitted by various ethnic groups. In a session recorded on April 13, 1974, at 8 o'clock p.m., Candy mumbled something about black people having a peculiar smell. Nebel asked her whether she truly believed that black people had an odor. Candy, to me they do. That's what he said. John, Jensen told you that? Candy, sure, I took the test. John, and you found that black people smell? Candy, sure, he identified them for me. John, do Jews smell? Candy, they have bad perspiration. Anybody does. John, then everyone smells the same. Candy, they, meaning the Jews, eat that kind of food and then they have that perspiration smell. John, did Jensen tell you that? Candy, he said that they eat highly seasoned stuff and then they perspire, especially if they're fat. John, what about the Italian people? Do they smell? Candy, they smell of garlic, usually Latin smell of garlic. John, did he tell you not to mingle with those people? He said not to mingle with any of them. He said that was the way to avoid trouble. Nebel then asked her what kind of people Jensen allowed her to associate with.
Candy, he never said. He told me that I was a good loner and should stay away from all people. He told me that I was self-sufficient and didn't need anybody, and that I would be much better off being alone. John, Arlene said that you were programmed to hate people. Candy, I don't like her. She gives me stomach aches. Interrupting here, recall that both Castillo and Saran, under the effects of questioning while under hypnosis, professed to have stomach aches. And one of the things that the hypno-programmers of Candy did was that they taught her to have Arlene Grant come up out of her stomach. Continuing here. Later in the same session, when Candy was struggling to keep Arlene inside, Nebel asked whether Jensen had taught Arlene to dislike black people. Candy said that Jensen had told Arlene to be careful because blacks could be dangerous, and he had said the same thing about Jews. She added during the latter portion of this session that Puerto Ricans were also not to be trusted. There are indications from the hypnotic session tapes that Gilbert Jensen had negative feelings about the black race long before he began indoctrinating Candy with those feelings. There are two hypnotic sessions in which Nebel regressed Candy back to her South Pacific days with Gilbert Jensen, and in both sessions she talked to Jensen about incidents involving black soldiers. In one session, according to the hypnotized Candy, Jensen told her she had better stay away from black soldiers because they would rape her. He also told her during their World War II days in Leyte that she must be very careful of people, particularly blacks, and that they must be closely observed for a clue as to what their motivations and actions might be. This prejudice preached by Gilbert Jensen during World War II, and more pointedly, as part of his CIA programming of Candy, is particularly unfortunate because of her natural inclinations had always been quite the opposite. Hers was among the first modeling agencies to actively promote and use black models. She numbered among her friends many Jews, and had apparently lived her life with an admirably open mind toward minority groups. But once the programming took effect, she found herself acting contrary to her inherent beliefs. On an undated tape, she talked to John Nebel, her alter ego, about what Jensen had told her concerning Negroes. According to the tape, Jensen had repeatedly asked her to tell him the names of her friends in New York and expressed his dissatisfaction with the fact that one of Candy's secretaries was a black girl who had been with Candy for 4 years. "Get rid of that girl," Jensen told her. "She's talking about you around town," unquote. Jensen then took out a snapshot he claimed he had taken of the black secretary outside the office building at 52 Vanderbilt Avenue in New York City. Candy was shocked that Jensen had been there and had taken the picture, and expressed her feelings to him. Jensen again insisted that she fire the girl, which Candy eventually did with mixed emotions. Another aspect of Candy's training had to do with observing people's mannerisms. Jensen gave her a pamphlet, the title of which she recalls was "The Human Face," unquote. She claims, under hypnosis, to have studied it as instructed and to have found the material helpful. The hypnotic session in which this booklet was mentioned took place in October of 1974. Nebel played the role of Jensen.
Okay. John, do you remember how I taught you to look at a person and you know something about him? Bear in mind, John is playing the role of Jensen. Candy, you gave me the book, meaning the pamphlet. John, surprised, do you remember the title? Candy, without hesitation, "The Human Face." John, who wrote it, remember? Candy, Brophy or someone like that. John, that's right, You've got a good memory. Did you study it? Candy. Oh, yes. It's so true. You can see it's true. I never thought of it that way. The weakness in the chin, the earlobes, the shape of the ear, the forehead, the placement of the eyes. All of this programming by Jensen and Berger was to be culminated, however, in a most extraordinary discussion class conducted by Berger in a small Texas town very close to the Louisiana border. This material came out on tape in early November 1974 and is contained in the transcripts of a hypnotic session between John Neble and Candy Jones. The hypnotic session began with Candy discussing Arlene. Arlene then emerged and said she was waiting for word from someone that would send her into action. Candy had complained at the very beginning of the session that her stomach hurt. Arlene told Neble that Candy had been poisoned, and Arlene suggested that the poison was in something Candy had recently eaten. Neble was unable to elicit further information about this, and the session proceeded to other topics. There was also regression back to Candy's childhood. Neble commented into the microphone that Candy had the most severe pain in her abdomen that he had ever witnessed, and that she was almost crying. She had also complained of leg pains. Neble worked to take away the pain, and succeeded after 3 minutes. Suddenly, Arlene's voice came through, and she told Neble about the severity of the pains Candy had just experienced. Quote, "I can't stand that stuff," Arlene said. Neble assumed she was referring to something she had been drinking, perhaps orange juice, in Jensen's office, and asked her about it. "It tastes just like boiled laundry," replied Arlene. "I ate the food in the test kitchen." Arlene then mumbled something that sounded to Neble like ugly. "Who is ugly?" he asked. "All of them. They eat this stuff. Maybe that's why they look like they do. They say you are what you eat. Can you come up with something that I could order and that I could eat? Something I can stand? Can you have plain rice? Would that be suspicious? Would it look strange? I could say I have a bad stomach or something." And Candy returned. "John, where are you now? What building are you in?" Candy. "I'm in the test kitchen, in the test lab." John, "What city are you in?" Candy, "There's no city." John, "What country then?" Candy, laughing, "You mean what state?" John, "Yes." Candy, "Texas."
And still later. Moments later, Candy, who was lying in bed throughout these hypnotic sessions, sat up and began yelling, "Caucasians are not the concubines of the blacks." Neville was shaken by this sudden outburst and tried to calm her. "It is revolting and it is disgusting," Candy screamed. John, "Who told you to say that?" Candy, Gil Jensen, "said to just look around and I'd see it, and I do see it." Her voice still strident. "Does a lion mate with a tiger?" John, "Do you know where you are right now?" Candy, "Yes, I'm in the discussion class, in the building outside of, I don't know where it is, Texas, Louisiana, Texas, on the border." John, "Who is your instructor?" Candy, "Dr. Berger." John, "That's the man you met in Chicago?" Candy, "I met him years ago." Suddenly whispering, "I'm not supposed to say that." John, "And he's the one that..." Candy, "Shh." John, "Why should I be quiet?" Candy, "I met him once before, but he pretends he doesn't know me." John, "And he's the one giving you instructions in class?" Candy, "It's just his discussion class." John, "Is it about blacks and whites?" Candy, "Blacks and whites and yellows and the whole thing. Integration is one thing, but mixed breeding is another. He is so right." John, "Do you agree with him?" Candy, "Oh, yes." John, "What else has he said in today's discussion class?" Candy, "He said it is always the minority group that tries to get the majority group to go with him. It'll be the blacks trying to get the whites to go with him, and the yellows trying to get the whites to go with him. It'll always be that way. Those people are very strong." John, "Where did you learn that? From Dr. Berger?" Candy, "Uh-huh, and I read it in the literature they give you." John, "What were some of the things they gave you? Do you remember?" Candy, "World power, world peace, peace is not a color," or something like that, becoming animated. "You go to the back of the room there, and they have the booklets on that little table. It's all free, and you can just take any ones you want." "How many people were in the discussion class?" Candy, 8 or 9 of us today." John, "And Dr. Berger is the main speaker?" Candy, "Yeah, they expected a whole lot of people, but something happened to the bus." John, "Has Gil Jensen been here?" Candy, "Oh, yes, he introduced him." John, "He introduced you to Berger?" Candy, "No, he introduced Berger to the class. He was the moderator of the class and introduced Berger." There is a break in the hypnotic session at this point. When it resumes, it appears to be Candy speaking, but her voice has taken on Arlene's familiar, militant, grating tone. candy. The black people will take over as much as they can. They will first get their white women and bring in as many offspring as they can. These people are going to be taking the white women and it'll be integration. It is wrong. John, is that what Dr. Berger said? Candy, oh yes, and it is wrong. It will happen. Berger told the whole thing and it makes sense. Nibble comments into the microphone that Candy is sitting up in bed, her face twisted into a hateful sneer. John, it makes sense to you? Candy, of course it does.
All right, skipping along and still continuing in the same thing. John is again asking Candy if she can see Jensen and what he has to say. Candy says, I don't say anything. I just listen. He is telling us all the truth. I know it's true because of all those pictures they show us, and it was disgusting. John, who gave you the pictures? Candy, they didn't give them to us. They showed them on the screen. They were up there, all those black men with white women. It was revolting, disgusting. Those white women going after the black men. It's going to be a bad scene. John, it's a bad situation, huh? Candy, it sure is. It's all true. John, is that what they're teaching in the organization? Candy, they show you. John, is that what the CIA, what Dr. Berger taught you? Candy, Marshall said that everybody knows a white who's going with a black. He said it is going to be some big problem. Marshall said that it is going to be tough on the children and that they should be sterilized. I think that's so. And that's what Berger taught you? Candy, uh-huh. Becoming vehement. They should be sterilized. They should not be allowed to bring in children. They should stick to their own kind. Does a tiger mate with a lion? John, was that what Dr. Berger said? Candy, he sure did. John, is Dr. Berger paid by the CIA? Candy, he is the CIA. He's important out here in discussions, but I don't know how big he is. Okay, now, skipping from the control of Candy Jones and back to another book.
Well, in evaluating this, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, if the things we've presented so far haven't scared you, I would think that this would. Candy, at least according to this account, was not a bigoted individual, and yet was turned into a real hater, and a hater of a number of different people, Jews, Italians, blacks, all kinds of people. And I think it's worth taking note of in this context that, at least to a certain extent, I think, to the extent that the federal intelligence agencies, the U.S. government, is involved in programming people in this fashion, it represents, maybe the ultimate legacy of the Galen organization that we've talked about, where Nazi war criminals were brought into the country, incorporated into the intelligence system, and, they say big oaks from little acorns grow, and this would appear to be at least one of the trees that sprang up from that particular Nazi acorn. And
well, again, I think that's got to scare you about as much as anything you could contemplate. Here you have a liberal woman being programmed with attitudes that would make David Duke blush under the circumstances. And when you have a government programming its own citizens in this kind of fashion, and with the kinds of technologies and methodologies that they have at their disposal, it is certainly, I think, time for all of us to run up the psychological and political SOS, because it is definitely long past the time when practices like this should have been directly addressed. It's also a chilling component to the growing presence of racism in our society and bigotry in our society. It's always been there. There is certainly an ongoing effort by the authorities to promote racism in this country. When George Bush or Ronald Reagan talks about holding down government spending, despite the fact that Ronald Reagan was the greatest government spender of all time, this is a code word. This basically means, again, if you'll pardon some strong language, let's get those spicks and niggers off of welfare who are spending our hard-earned tax dollars. It's a very well-understood code word out in middle America, and when Jane and Joe Sixpack sit down in front of the evening news and they hear Ronald Reagan saying that, they agree with it because they understand what he's saying. It's okay to bankrupt the United States if we're going to spend billions and billions of dollars on weapon systems, but hey, we better not spend anything on social services for people of other races and other ethnic groups. And ultimately, when this country experiences the financial collapse, which I personally view as inevitable, not a view certainly unique to myself, I think the degree of scapegoating of people of color, minorities, poor people, is going to grow. And ultimately, I think we may very well face something in this country along the lines of what happened in Nazi Germany and elsewhere. The Nazi leaders were very candid, some of them anyway, in their private writings, that the Jews were not responsible for Germany's economic problems, but it became necessary to blame someone for the extreme suffering that the German people experienced first under the runaway inflation of the early 1920s and later under the Great Depression, which was far worse in Germany than here in the United States. And I think we would do well to ponder the future in light of what the authorities are doing, both in terms of broad-based social propaganda and, even more chillingly, in the programming of individual human beings such as Candy Jones. Now, the next area of mind control that I'm going to discuss is one which is somewhat better known than the various individual techniques for control or techniques for controlling the individual human brain through actual interference with the natural physiological processes which go on in the cerebral cortex. We are going to talk next about mind control cults in general, but specifically about certain mind control cults which give strong evidence of being tied in with the military and or intelligence services, both of this country and of others. The mind control cult offers an intelligence agency or a government a means of creating a cadre, literally a group of people who can be committed to a particular purpose, whereas an individual human being who has been placed under mind control can be utilized as an assassin or a courier or whatever, or to be made to hate, as Candy Jones was. If you can get a group of people acting together and control their behavior and beliefs, you have a very, very powerful tool for effecting political control. One of the cults which gives very strong evidence of having been, if not actually a CIA or military intelligence operation, certainly deeply connected with the U.S. national security establishment, one which also has particular significance for those of us here in the San Francisco Bay Area, was of course the People's Temple, and headed up by Jim Jones. There are very serious indications that the People's Temple may very well have been an extension, an underground extension, of the various mind control programs which we've been touching on this evening, albeit an extension of those programs to group social dynamics. Jim Jones had been observed when he was in Brazil to be frequently visited by cars bearing the seal of the United States Embassy to Brazil. Interestingly enough, the person who put down the down payment on the property in Guyana, which ultimately became the people, it became Jonestown, was a fellow named George Philip Blakey, who had worked for the CIA in Angola in the mid-1970s. He was a Jones lieutenant. Interestingly, he was married to the sister of Larry Layton Jr. The entire Layton family was deeply involved with the People's Temple and Lawrence Layton Sr. Larry Layton Jr., of course, was the fellow who led the assassination team at Port Kaituma, which dispatched, among others, the Representative Leo Ryan from San Mateo, about whom I will have more to say in a couple of minutes. But Lawrence Layton Sr. was in charge of research and development for the U.S. Chemical and Biological Warfare Research Facility at Dugway, Utah, which has had a fair amount of publicity. Interestingly enough, Lawrence Layton Sr. had married a woman named Lisa Philip, who was the daughter of an attorney who worked for the Nazi IG Farben chemical cartel during World War II and who came over to the United States. It's worth noting that Richard Dwyer, the CIA chief of mission in Guyana, was actually present at the massacre at Jonestown. There is a tape of Jim Jones saying, "Get Dwyer out of here, get Dwyer out of here." It is known that the People's Temple, the individuals and the People's Temple grouping at Jonestown in Guyana were very active on behalf of the CIA-installed government of Forbes Burnham in Guyana. It's also worth noting that there are very serious discrepancies in the official version of what happened with the supposed mass suicide. Dr. Moto, the coroner who examined the bodies of the people who died at Jonestown noted that most of them had been murdered. They were not suicide victims. Many of them died of gunshot wounds. This was not reported. Many more of them died of injections rather than drinking the poisoned Kool-Aid, as we were all told they did. Beyond that, if you go back and examine the newspaper clippings at the time of the Jonestown massacre, initially there were reported to be 1,100 people at Jonestown. Then somehow 200 of them mysteriously vanished from the official estimate. Many people have believed that those 200 were actually Jim Jones' lieutenants. Interestingly, the People's Temple was composed primarily of people of color, black people in particular, but that Jim Jones himself had surrounded himself with white lieutenants, so that the People's Temple leadership were almost all white. The poor SOBs who were on the receiving ends of his various activities, and I'll talk about some of the factors that appear to have been involved in mind control there in a minute, the poor SOBs on the receiving end of his various activities, including the massacre, were mostly people of color, as I said, blacks in particular. The version was given at the time of the massacre that initially only 400 bodies had been discovered. We were told 1,100 passports had been granted to people to go down to Jonestown. That number then shrank to 900. But for several days, for 4 or 5 days, there were questions in the media about what had happened to the other 500 people. 400 bodies were reported being found. For several days, I believe it was 4 days, I would have to double check that, there were speculations about what had happened to the other 500. At the end of the better part of a week of supposed searching for those 500, the official version was handed out, Warren Commission-esque in its absurdities, that the other 500 had been discovered. They were under the first 400 bodies all along. This is the official version. You can go back and check the press accounts at the time. That the reason they couldn't find the other 500 was that all along they were under the first 400. If you look at the pictures of the victims of the Jonestown massacre, you will find that there's no way that 500 bodies could have been hidden under the first 400, even if you were inclined to believe that obviously incredible assertion to begin with. Beyond that, it's worth noting that in pictures, there's a picture on the cover of Time magazine, for example, there are numerous pictures of the corpses at Jonestown. The vast majority of them were lying face down. After decomposing, this made recognition very, very difficult. Had there in fact been a random either mass suicide, as we are told, or a massacre, it is extremely unlikely that the vast majority of the bodies would have been lying face down. Some of them would have been, some of them would have been lying on their backs. But the overwhelming majority were lying face down. After several days in the tropics, this would have made a positive identification extremely difficult. If you also go back and look at the pictures, you will find that most of the corpses had identification tags either around their wrist or ankles, the kind of identification tags that one finds on people who are patients in hospitals or psychiatric patients. Beyond that, there are a number of other very interesting things concerning the Jonestown operation. For one thing, the massacre at Jonestown took place during the public hearings on the House Select Committee of Assassinations, alleged investigation of the assassinations of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. At the time that Mark Lane, now an attorney for the neo-Nazi Liberty Lobby, at the time that Mark Lane was representing the People's Temple, and he was the People's Temple attorney, he was also representing James Earl Ray, the supposed assassin of Martin Luther King. Ray is demonstrably innocent, I should say. One of the interesting things is that Mark Lane was going all over the place saying that the People's Temple was a heaven on earth, it was a paradise on earth. He was also staunchly maintaining that James Earl Ray was innocent. The day before, it was a Friday, the People's Temple massacre at Jonestown took place. That occurred on a Saturday night. There was very moving testimony in Congress by a former FBI agent named Murtaugh. I believe that was his name. I'm operating from memory. But in any event, a former FBI agent, as I recall, named Murtaugh, gave extremely moving testimony in the public hearings in which he literally wept. He wept at his recollection, at his recounting of the evident joy, the jubilation, the shouting that broke out in the Atlanta office when the news of Martin Luther King, the Atlanta FBI office, when the news of Martin Luther King's death came over the radio. The FBI agents on station in the Atlanta FBI office openly cheered the news of Martin Luther King's death. This FBI agent actually broke down in tears, while a former FBI agent broke down in tears while recounting this on the floor of Congress. Well, as soon as the Jonestown massacre took place, obviously people were not thinking about the House Select Committee on Assassinations. They were thinking about this monstrous thing which had occurred. Also, Mark Lane, who had been staunchly maintaining that James Earl Ray was innocent, just as he had staunchly maintained on numerous radio programs that the People's Temple was a paradise on earth, looked like God's own fool, and by association, people would have assumed that, well, he wasn't right about the People's Temple, he probably isn't right about the assassination of Martin Luther King and James Earl Ray's innocence. Still more interesting to me is a memorandum, a People's Temple internal memorandum, from Mark Lane to Jones Lieutenant Terry Buford, herself the daughter of a naval intelligence agent. Actually, he was a high-ranking naval officer, I believe ONI, but again, I'm working from memory. Anyway, in the New York Times in December of 1978, there is an article in which Mark Lane describes his plan to have a woman named Grace Stevens sent down to Jonestown in Guyana. Now, Grace Stevens was the common-law wife of a fellow named Charles Q. Stevens. Charles Q. Stevens had been the only eyewitness, and eyewitness here belongs in quotes, to link James Earl Ray with the rooming house from which he supposedly fired the shot that killed Dr. Martin Luther King. It should be noted that at the time at which Charles Q. Stevens was supposedly IDing James Earl Ray, he was passed out drunk, according to a taxicab driver who had been called to drive him. According to this taxicab driver, he was stone-cold drunk at the time. Not an unusual state for Charles Q. Stevens to have been in. He had a record of 136 arrests for public drunkenness. In fact, for a couple of days after the assassination of Dr. King, he said that he thought a black person had assassinated Dr. King. He said, "I'd never testify against a man who killed Martin Luther Coon, even if it was a nigger who done it." However, after the FBI babysat Charles Q. Stevens and paid $30,000 in bar tabs for Charles Q. Stevens, and bear in mind, that's $30,000, 1968. The dollar has inflated considerably since. That's a lot of booze, particularly for a fellow like Charles Q. Stevens, who was probably used to Thunderbird or Night Train or some of the cheap fortified wines which individuals of that ilk are inclined to imbibe. But it should be noted that then Charles Q. Stevens became the only eyewitness to link James Earl Ray with the rooming house from which he supposedly fired the shot that killed Dr. King. Grace Stevens testified that she saw a man running down the hall and that that man didn't look anything like James Earl Ray. Well, had Mark Lane been successful, and bear in mind he was James Earl Ray's, quote, defense attorney, unquote, at the time, had he been successful in getting Grace Stevens down to Jonestown, she would have been eliminated at the massacre. It's also worth noting that Congressman Leo Ryan was, of course, he was one of the people killed at the Port Kaituma airstrip ambush. He was the co-author of the Hughes-Ryan Amendment, which obliged the Central Intelligence Agency to give Congress prior notification of impending CIA covert operations. It is my belief, and I want to stress this is my personal opinion, that the Jonestown operation not only was a U.S. intelligence operation, but as is the case with operations undertaken by the U.S. National Security Establishment, it was meant to scratch a number of different itches at different levels simultaneously. In the first place, it was meant to eliminate what in all probability was an ongoing and illegal CIA operation. When Congressman Ryan went down to Jonestown, he might very well have discovered what was going on. Had the truth come out, This might have been damaging to the agency. In the second place, they discredited the investigation into the assassination of Martin Luther King, not only by overshadowing the House Select Committee on Assassinations, but also by making Mark Lane, Ray's defense attorney, like a complete fool. He'd been going all over the place saying that James Earl Ray was innocent. He was also, and he also was going all over the place saying that that Jonestown was a paradise on earth. Well, not many people would have been inclined to believe him after that. Also, I believe that a message was being sent to Congress that, hey, folks, we don't want any more interference in our operations. Look what happened to Leo Ryan. He co-authored the Hughes-Ryan Amendment. Well, he's not around anymore, and we don't want any more investigations like the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Let's have a halt to this, and then we'll take the heat off. I also think that the people at Jonestown were being used for experimentation, an extension of the CIA and military's mind control programs. Huge quantities of psychiatric drugs were discovered at Jonestown. Jones was in the habit of enforcing various mind control techniques on the people at Jonestown and the People's Temple. They were often forced to stay up all night in various drills practicing for the so-called White Knights. When Jones told them they would be attacked by the U.S. government, people were punished by being placed into solitary confinement so austere that it in effect represented sensory deprivation, a very threatening form of enforcing one's way on people psychologically. When people are deprived of sensory input, they are often, at a certain period of time, they begin to hallucinate, and it is described as a very, very threatening experience. Children who were viewed by Jones as being delinquent were brutally punished with extremely harsh beatings. The people at Jonestown and in the People's Temple in general were deprived of sleep. They were also fed very strange diets, extremely high carbohydrate diets, low protein diets, which can alter human mental behavior. That's also a technique that is followed by the Unification Church, about which I'll say more in a minute. One of the interesting aspects to the People's Temple was that there was a People's Temple hit list which emerged into public view after the massacre. The authorities poo-pooed the existence of such a hit list. Or no, the hit list emerged, but they poo-pooed the existence of a People's Temple hit squad or death team to enforce this. The first name on the People's Temple hit list was Mayor George Moscone of San Francisco, who was assassinated 9 days after the Jonestown massacre. People's Temple had been deeply involved in the Moscone campaign. They had also been very much involved in the successful campaign to elect Harvey Milk to the city council. My feeling is, and again, I want to emphasize that this is my personal opinion, that with the assassinations of Harvey Milk and George Moscone, the political, well, obviously, two key figures of the liberal political leadership of San Francisco were eliminated. I also feel that this precluded any investigation into the nature of the political relationship between Moscone and Harvey Milk and the People's Temple. The viewpoint at the time was that the family had suffered enough. Let's not cause them any more suffering by looking into what would certainly prove to be an altogether embarrassing relationship, possibly very damaging to the authorities if, in fact, Jonestown was the intelligence operation that it appears to have been. The second name on the People's Temple hit list, and bear in mind that the People's Temple death squad did not exist. Oh, by the way, Dan White, who slew Harvey Milk and George Moscone, may also very well have been a mind control assassin. His wife, interestingly, had for a time been a U.S. Army psychologist, and it is the view of many that Dan White was in all probability a programmed assassin as well. He certainly hated Harvey Milk. He also hated George Moscone. However, there is a big difference between one politician despising another and walking into City Hall and blowing away both of them in broad daylight. One of the interesting things, too, is that the second and third names on the People's Temple hit list were the names of Jeannie and Al Mills, both of whom were former People's Temple members. They had defected, and Jeannie Mills wrote a very, very critical book about the People's Temple called My 6 Years with God. In the summer of 1979, Al and Jeannie Mills and their daughter were found shot to death in their home in Berkeley. The news accounts at the time described a bullet-riddled door being taken out. The killing has never been solved. The first investigative pathway pursued by the police was their son, who had been in the house at the time they were killed, but said he didn't hear anything. That suggests to me that the weapon may have been a silenced weapon, or perhaps he himself had been placed under some form of mind control. But bear in mind, the killings were never solved. They took place in the summer of 1979. You can read about them. My own feeling is that there probably was a People's Temple hit squad. Certainly, the first three names on the People's Temple hit list bit the dust within a year, of the people of the Jonestown Massacre. The Jonestown Massacre took place in November of 1978. George Moscone was dead of an assassin's bullet 9 days later. He was number one. Al and Jeannie Mills were next on the list. They were dead of assassin's bullets by the summer of 1979. Another of the intelligence-connected mind-control cults, something which I've discussed on the air recently, is, of course, the Unification Church of Reverend Sun Myung Moon. The Unification Church had as many of its key lieutenants, people who had been involved first with the Imperial Japanese military during World War II. Recall that Korea had been a Japanese colony from 1905, when it was taken from the Russian Empire, up until 1945, when Japan lost the Second World War, or at least for about 50 years. It appears that they're in better shape now than we are. But Korea, because it had been a Japanese colony, had a fair participation in the Imperial Japanese military. Most of Moon's early lieutenants, including most notably his top lieutenant, Bo Hee Pak, began their military and national security careers as members of the Imperial Japanese Officer Corps during World War II. After that, Jones relied very heavily on support from the Korean CIA, the Korean counterpart and effective co-player with our own Central Intelligence Agency. During the Korea Gate hearings in 1978, it emerged that the People's Temple was in effect a tool of the Korean CIA, not only in the United States, but elsewhere in the world. The Unification Church has since become a major element, not only in extreme right-wing politics in this country, but also in fascist politics in other countries as well. It is deeply involved with the former World Anti-Communist League, a fascist organization which is now most inappropriately renamed the World League for Freedom and Democracy. One of the things discussed in Radio Free America Program 7, in the context of a discussion of the People's Temple, this was reprised in the Frontline special called The Resurrection of Reverend Moon, aired on public broadcasting system on January 21st of 1992. Two of Moon's early supporters, were two Japanese fascists, both interned as war criminals in Sagamo Prison at the end of World War II. One of them, Yoshio Kodama, the other, Roichi Sasakawa, a very, very wealthy individual who once described himself as the world's richest fascist. The Unification Church also practices mind control techniques on its adherents, ranging from love bombing, the physical embracing of a recruit into the People's Temple, telling him how great he or she is, and literally that's called love bombing. They also are subjected to sleep deprivation, dietary manipulation. High carbohydrate diets are fed to the hockey pucks that they have out there selling flowers and other things. Also, psychiatric drugs, according to first-hand accounts that I have, are administered to many of the low-level flunkies of the Unification Church. Again, Radio Free America number 7 has a discussion of this. The Unification Church is quite well known. And its mind control component is quite well known. That is perhaps the best example of what an organization like this is capable of producing if you're willing to subject this cadre to broad-based techniques of social intellectual control. A couple of other cults that might be worth mentioning. First of all, there are some interesting aspects to the Hare Krishnas, a very familiar sight at airports in the 60s and 70s with their orange robes and their chanting and their beating of tambourines.